Hello and welcome to the Foot Health Show here on UK Health Radio, your global real feel-good radio station. My name is Peter Alton of Circle Podiatry.
And my name is Jonathan Brocklehurst. It's our aim to raise your awareness of just how important your feet are, to give you the solutions to your foot and leg problems, and to teach you how to prevent future issues.
So grab a cuppa, relax, sit back and put your feet up and enjoy learning about the one part of your body that often gets forgotten. That's right, it's your feet.
Thank you for listening to the Foot Health Show on UK Health Radio. My name is Jonathan Brocklehurst, and today we will be exploring a topic that shows us just how important our feet are. This show is all about the significance of our foot health in our everyday lives, the decisions we make, and the information we read and listen to relating to our foot health can be a beacon to others. And that is why the Foot Health Show exists, to inform you of inspiring and innovative ways to address our feet and mobility in the current world. We are grateful for the support the show receives from across the world. And if you are interested and feel this show matches your vision for shedding light on the importance of our foot health in enhancing our lives and preventing limb loss across the globe, please refer to the UK Health Radio website with details on sponsorship and donations.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things. Make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back. And if you've just tuned in, you are listening to the Foot Health Show on UK Health Radio. I hope you've enjoyed listening so far. And if you've enjoyed listening to the show as much as I've enjoyed making it, then please don't hesitate to contact me on LinkedIn or Twitter, and I will happily respond to your messages as soon as I possibly can. Meanwhile, here's a piece of music I hope you'll enjoy.
You're better than my dreams. Thought I found love so many times till you showed me what it means. Oh, nothing compares to you. Oh no, baby, they were just doing it wrong.
That was a lovely piece of music. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And now we're about to go into our interview with our very special guest today. And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Foot Health Show on UK Health Radio. And to be in touch with us, please do go and visit the UK Health Radio website, where you can find all content here from the Foot Health Show. So without any further ado, here's our interview with our very special guest.
So you're listening to the Foot Health Show here on UK Health Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. Today, I'm going to be interviewing a very special guest with us all the way from California in the USA. It's Tiedwin. Thank you so much for coming on today. Someone who's very, very much prevalent in the world of podiatry, specifically Pacific Point Podiatry. And also, I just want to give a very warm welcome to you, T. Thank you so much. And could you just give us a little bit about yourself, about the backgrounds and why it is that you're so passionate about podiatry?
Jonathan, I'm so excited to be here because who doesn't love to talk about feet? Okay, I do a little bit more than my friends. So I had opened my private practice in 2016, and I opened it as an insurance-based practice because here in the U.S., we have privatized health insurance. And just recently, I had pivoted out of the insurance model and went into the direct care podiatry practice model. So it's a cash practice. It's a very easy transaction. And I specialize in minimally invasive surgery and diabetic foot care. So I get to do everything that I absolutely love without any hindrance. And it's direct care between patients and me. So that's what I'm currently doing. I also have a three-year-old who's turning on to four. This June, and she's acting like a 14-year-old, but you know, that's just how it goes sometimes. So I'm happily also a mom and a wife to a general surgeon husband. So I think we've got our hands pretty full.
Fantastic. Now I understand what that's like with my wife and our two-year-old son, and he definitely lets us know who's going to be boss. So I get that. No, definitely. And it's a fun age as well. But actually, that's quite relevant in terms of just the span of the age range that we can see in clinic, from pediatrics to right up to geriatric care. And actually, I wanted to talk a little bit about that, and particularly with your minimally invasive surgery that you do. And I've obviously referenced to your husband as a surgeon too. How do you kind of, I guess, you know, talking about coming back from work, chat about your interactions with patients, about how you go about surgery? Do you share tips, or how does it work?
My husband and I are not work compatible, if that's like the nicest way to say it. So what's really cool is that I get to share a lot of cases with him. So early on in my career, when I was doing hospital work, I would double scrub in his cases for like a major limb amputation, because I was very familiar with the anatomy, but it's out of my scope. But it's within his scope, and he could, you know, the lower extremity is kind of like just a thing he has to do, right? So it was nice to be able to collaborate and do the best we could for the patients as far as limb preservation as much as we can. But for other things, you know, I run a private practice business, which is far beyond him, and he has no interest in business of medicine. So he's a happily employed associate, and he just prefers it that way. So we do get to bounce ideas on perspective, on maybe what do I think about what it's like to be an associate and what he thinks about private practice. And then with him, I get to engage into dialogue that's maybe more, I can tap into his mind a little bit more to get a general understanding of those who may not be speaking in private practice language. So it's pretty fun to be able to collaborate both inside and outside the office.
That's fantastic. And actually, that leads me on to the way that it is with patients and how you interact with patients too. Now, obviously, we get a wide range of patients that come into clinic, of course, and, you know, some are genuinely interested to be there. And some sometimes, you know, it can be a little bit more tricky and challenging to kind of understand where they're coming from and why they may feel the way they do. But how do you find, for example, let's say as a case study, a patient comes in, you obviously you're going to conduct some minimally invasive surgery, and they may be more slightly reluctant for any reason. How do you deal with those reluctances? And then how do you deal with any barriers that may seem to crop up? Because I think for many people, I mean, many listening today across the globe, you know, some may be patients as well as clinicians, questions and want to just find out that what's a good way to practice and what's a good way to ensure that patients, whether they're confident in your treatments or whether they may be feeling a little bit reluctant or a little bit nervous maybe about it, how do you kind of approach that?
I think there is a lot to unveil with your question. So first off, I make it very obvious what services I offer. So it's available online or through my Google Ads is where I put my advertising dollars into. And so patients have a general idea of what they're looking for. Maybe they're looking for a foot and ankle specialist who does minimally invasive surgery. And because MIS is such a common term these days, people kind of know to look for that. And if they don't, then that's where the opportunity I have to educate patients. You can undergo traditional open surgery. This is what that looks like. Or you can also opt for minimally invasive surgery, which is what I do. And so I think being able to empower patients with information gives them the confidence and freedom to choose. So they have all this information, risk and benefits in both scenarios, because I still perform both. And then they can decide what works for them. For some people, they want to undergo traditional surgery that requires pins, screws, and plates in a hospital setting. And that is just the way we've been doing it in medicine for so long. More recently, minimally invasive surgery has been more of an appeal, especially throughout the pandemic when people are not trying to be in the hospital or interact with more people as it becomes, you know, as it relates to patient care. And so they're electing for office-based surgeries instead. But I think just empowering patients with information that is legitimate rather than having them look for it on their own on Google, we empower them with information, and that's how they get to choose.
And that's a really important point, actually. I would agree with you. I think information and the patient education is so, so key to be able to grapple so much about what, you know, people want to find out. And I think, you know, some of which they may look on, like you say, they may just look on a website, and, you know, your website, of course, and websites that are bona fide and have information sourced from evidence-based practice, of course, that side of it is very good. But then on the other side, there are websites which they may randomly click on and they see, you know, that the information may not be as it should. So I think it's really important that you made that distinction between the kinds of information we can get out there. But let's kind of shift a little bit to diabetic foot care, because I know this is something that obviously for myself, that I've been very much involved with as a diabetes specialist podiatrist, but also for you, how have you approached it at diabetic foot care? What are some fundamental things that you can share with us, with the listeners today about diabetic foot care? And then we can kind of really grapple that further.
The caring of diabetic patients who have foot problems is a spectrum. And when I used to work in a wound clinic, I often got them at the end stage of things. They had undergone prior amputations. They have these chronic wounds that recur because they don't have a podiatrist who does maintenance care, or maybe their original podiatrist is just fully overloaded and they can't be seen for 6 months or however long it is. So I had a very hard time with this. Patients just didn't get the consistent care after they were discharged from the wound center. And so now I have to kind of pull back and see where can I capture these patients where I can actually give them good information and education in prevention so they don't have to end up in the ER or the urgent care for something that is manageable in the office. And oftentimes, yeah, things that are manageable in the office just requires a phone call or a video conference or them taking a picture saying, hey, doc, what do you think about this? And when patients feel like they don't have access to their doctor, the next best place that they go is the ER because it's open 24/7. And so I'm having to educate people early on. As soon as they come in my office, this is my cell phone number. If you have any questions or any changes in your medical health or somebody else in your family notices something different about you, I want you to call me right away, any time of the day.
Absolutely. And can just for listeners across the globe, anyone who doesn't know what ER means, could you just mention that briefly? What does ER mean?
In the US, the ER is the emergency room, or we also call it emergency department. And this is a service that's available for emergencies. However, our system is so clogged up with a long waiting list that people don't really get to access their medical doctors as fast as they could or should. And so that becomes a primary source of medical care for a lot of Americans now.
Yes, and obviously with the COVID-19 pandemic, I imagine, and obviously in the UK it hit us quite hard, but in the US, I imagine it hit you very hard as well. But how have you managed? That's actually quite a big question, I know it is, but in terms of how, as doctors and in terms of podiatry, how have you really dealt with the pandemic? I know you said about the video conferencing, being able to speak to patients, especially, I guess, more remote areas in that way. But what's the response been like to that in terms of, as a surgeon, how do you deal with that?
When the pandemic hit here in March of 2020, I already had plans in place to offer more office-based surgery. So I was already implementing things that could be done in the office rather than the hospital, because in my training, most of our surgical care was hospital-based. And that was just kind of normal for us. And now I had to learn a new skill to bring in safety protocols and measures that I can do it in the office to break away from the dependency of a bigger system and allow them to preserve their resources for more serious condition. So in 2020, I was actually still very busy because people knew I was doing work in the clinic and trying to help them avoid the emergency room or the urgent care center or the hospital setting. And so I was really busy in 2020. And then we moved on to 2021, where I started to move away from the insurance-based practice, the privatized health insurance, where people just end up now just paying cash, which means they can get direct care if they just knock on my door and they say, hey, can I just get some service today? And it's a quick transaction versus having to deal with a third-party payer, and the wait time can be weeks before getting to be seen.
Right. So that's actually interesting. So in the US, there really is this system with insurance, as opposed to what you're trying to do, which is to streamline it so you've got quicker access to the treatment you need, which I guess in the UK is actually fairly similar to private practice here, in that we're trying to essentially deal with the, like you say, the backlog of what's needed. And often in the UK, if it's podiatry related, it's, you know, foot care, you know, like, you know, nails, corns, callus, you know. But when it gets to things like, I suppose for you, with minimally invasive surgery and getting things like wounds, obviously the urgency is going to be a lot higher, potentially. And I think something I noticed in during the pandemic and working in with the NHS was that just the way that some patients would say, they've come in, and I've never heard anything like it, they'd say, this was like winning the lottery just to get an appointment. You know, they're waiting for 6 months sometimes, and like you said, that can be really disconcerting for a lot of people, especially if they're trying to get urgent care for something like a diabetic foot ulcer. And that actually brings me on nicely to how you would manage, obviously, the chronicity of a wound can exacerbate with just the amount of infection that can then get deeper and deeper to bone, possible osteomyelitis, and then you've got that side of things. But how do you deal with it in terms of, you know, I certainly found that there were patients that came in with what we would call more of the worst case scenario, where the wound would start to then infect the bone, and then you're looking at, you know, limb loss prevention. And I think that you are anyway, I suppose, in the preventative side, but that side was, you know, particularly urgent. So how did you kind of approach that if you happened to see patients that were in a further stage of their infection?
I do see patients from all of the spectrum, from being newly diagnosed diabetics all the way to they're getting an amputation or have had an amputation. So I try to promote just general foot care, general wellness around foot care, because otherwise if you ignore it, it becomes an amputation. So that's the part of the education where I really enjoy sharing my experiences and things that I could have done, and try to put that information to the patient, letting them know, if we don't deal with this callus, this can damage your skin, which then can become infected. And that's how diabetics develop infections, because their immune system is down. It doesn't recognize an infection is happening until you're very, very sick. So palliative foot care is a critical role in education, because each encounter that they come in, I'm telling them the same story to remind them of the importance of foot care and that it should not be put off. Even though if they're just thinking they're just coming in for a routine foot care exam, it's really more than that. It's catching things early enough to do something about it, versus we're at the end stage and now we have no choice but to amputate.
Yeah, it's a really, really tough one. I think, you know, like you said, the information, blending it from what we were saying at the beginning to coming up to now, what we're saying now, is patient education and information is key, and the quality of that information is also really, really key. So, you know, thank you for enlightening us on that. And I think coming back to something about the US system, I wanted you to just kind of elaborate a little bit more on that, because in the UK, the idea that we have to pay, to some extent, obviously with private practice, yes, but the NHS, not so much. It's a free service. So with that, how do many people in the US kind of handle that system? And is it something that you recommend, or is it something you would say you would recommend more to steer towards paying at the door?
This is a really tough question. And I'll share with you my experience. When I opened up my practice in 2018, it was insurance-based, which meant I was contracted with a lot of insurances and I would accept their contracted rate despite my billing charges. So if I had charged for $200, but they really said, no, we're only going to pay you $100, then you're kind of stuck with that rate, right? And the problem that comes with that is that we have to work so much harder for that $100, because now we have to hire a biller. We have to have a billing system to create those claims. We have to track, did those claims even get paid? Because it can take anywhere from 30 to 90 days to receive that payment for that service. I had a couple of checks that came in 12 months after the fact. And so now we have this huge log in our accounts receivable of unpaid claims that we don't really know if it's going to come in or not. And then we have to deal with collections. If patients don't pay, then now we have to like hire on additional services to chase the money that was owed to us long, long time ago. So in essence, when we contract with insurances, we are increasing our overhead without increasing the quality of our care. And actually we are degrading the quality of care because the payments are so low, there's no way to support the time to take care of the patient because it's volume based. Now we have to see a lot more patients to make more money. And then we start to act like an assembly line. So in that regard, when I'm in a type of elective type of outpatient care, insurance, having health insurance contracts was a disadvantage to me because I couldn't give timely care. It wasn't efficient. And there was just a lot of interference in trying to help patients get what they need or what I consider as best practices. So in that setting, I converted into direct cash practice. I still promote patients to have some coverage of insurance for catastrophic incidences, car accidents, heart attacks, things that we truly cannot control and will require hospitalization. So catastrophic health insurance is beneficial because then you don't really have to worry that much about what the hospital bills are like, assuming you're in contract with all of their services that they provide. And that is there's a little bit of a problem in that. So let's say you got into a car accident and you required surgery, but the surgeon requires anesthesia, and anesthesia is not contracted with your particular insurance, but you're kind of out of it and you have no choice in the matter. Then you get a bill months later. And the problem I have with that is you didn't have a choice. You didn't have a choice to ask for somebody in network because this happens to be the person on call, even though they're doing a life-saving procedure. But the fact that in America, our number one problem is not being able to pay health insurance, our health care, people go bankrupt because of their health care cost, says a lot about our system. So if you're in a country where you're moving towards privatized insurance, just take a look at what the Americans are doing right now. And it's doctors are burned out. We're at like 80% of doctors wanting to leave medicine currently. So it's not a perfect model. It works in some small sectors, but I don't think for preventive care, it's a really good model.
No, it sounds like there's a 85% is a big figure. And I think, you know, certainly reflects something that needs to be urgently addressed. In the UK, the issue that we've had, I think, is since the pandemic, of course, we were expecting that there would be taking its toll on a lot of clinicians, particularly if they've not experienced that level of pressure before. I certainly found that it was a lot of pressure. But I think, yes, it's true to say, I think that there does seem to be a dichotomy between the US and the UK system, for example. I don't know that much necessarily about the rest of European countries and further afield, India, Australia, etc. But I do think if we're focusing on America for now, that clearly if someone can't access podiatry care at a certain point of need or it costs them extra, and obviously it's costing the surgeons a lot more time and less money, then it kind of sounds like there's a little bit of a lose-lose situation on both sides. But at the same time, I think your idea about having it that patients can come in and pay the money, they get, you say, the $200, and they absolutely, they've had their treatment, it could possibly save a lot more, long-term, etc. And so I do think that's a really, really important point. I think I'd like to come back to the diabetic foot again, because again, in America, bearing in mind the system now that we've learned about, and for those listening across the world today again, it's really important to bear in mind the context with the care and the treatment, as opposed to just literally the treatment itself. How do you find, let's say, we mentioned about amputations. That, of course, is something across the world right now is a major concern, and we want to eradicate that if possible. What are some things that your practice is doing? Yes, the information part, but in treatment part, of course, there are ideas, things like footwear advice, but also the use of vasocast boots, for example, obviously others available too. What are some things that you've got in terms of stock, in terms of treatments that can really, really help deal with that?
When I had worked in the wound care center, I had encountered patients who were dealing with wound care for over a year for a foot problem. And as soon as I received the patient, I'm instantly thinking, how do we get this to heal faster? And it's to our advantage to learn about minimally invasive surgery. So forefoot ulcers, for example, those are pressure ulcers, and I can offload them with the office surgical procedure by breaking the bone. So that has been the fastest way to heal an ulcer. And so I feel that being able to offer an office-based solution that is quick, that is not intimidating, patients are ready to accept, that's how I'm able to prevent longer sequelae of wounds that patients have.
Right, so breaking the bone, do I get that right? In terms of
it's a strategic breaking of bone. Yes. So it's it's a specific osteotomy that you just break without fixation. And I've done so many surgeries with patients using fixation pins and wires and screws in diabetic patients, and they end up having pin track infections, and it spreads, and then it becomes a whole nother problem. So I had started to lean into minimally invasive procedures beyond tenotomies, beyond soft tissue corrections. And so now I'm doing office procedures, having to break the bone, which is often the source of the pressure, to surgically offload these ulcers.
Right. So recognizing the bone itself, this is actually a really important point that you're raising, that the bone itself has a key role to play in the pressures that actually are applied to an area. Let's just say it's the first metatarsophalangeal joint on the plantar aspect, and there's a wound there. And what you're saying is that by the procedure on the bone, it can alleviate the pressure on the
faster
upper pressure ulcer, for example. Yeah.
It'll heal an ulcer faster. We had been trained to do soft tissue releases of the Achilles tendon, but data has already shown that these contract again just because of the glycosylation of soft tissue. So even if we did the tendon lengthening, it can contract again, causing forefoot pressures. So it's a lot more efficient in my hands to just do the forefoot osteotomy and just do it as a functional correction. It's not always going to look pretty. They will continue to have deformities down the line. And that's where I try to maintain patients in my practice long term, so I can track the work that I've done for the patient and the changes they experience that just comes naturally with age and diabetes.
Wow. Okay. So that's a really interesting point, of course, because from what I've been used to doing is use of debridement, dressings, But it seems like with the procedure of the surgery, it really does showcase how important surgery can be in wound care, in diabetes management of the diabetic foot. I mean, that's really, really an eye-opener for me actually today. And I'm sure it is for many across the globe, that there are multiple ways of approaching, and possibly, like you're saying, possibly quicker ways. And if we can reduce the time for an ulcer to occur, then of course, and increase healing time, that's really, really critical. So no, thank you for that. And I think that does shed light. Sort of concluding now towards the end of this interview, is kind of just your thoughts really on where you think the future of surgery can be when it comes to diabetes, the diabetic foot, for example. Let's focus on that. And what sort of tools do you think are coming through that you think will really benefit not just clinicians, but patients as well?
I think moving into diabetic wound healing, we already know that the collaboration needs to exist in order for this to be effective. We need the circulation intervention. We need the nutritionalist. We need someone to manage home health and so on. So as far as podiatry goes, I bet you every single podiatrist involved in diabetic wound care, one day or another, they're just going to have to learn how to do office-based surgeries, minimally invasive surgeries, to offload these wounds quickly, so that the patients can remain active, to have their sugars under control, to be functional, and to alleviate some of the mental health that comes with having a long duration of a wound, and essentially giving them a better quality of life at the end of the day. So an office-based procedure is something that's already available here in the US. I don't know what that looks like in the UK, but most of our patients are already neuropathic. So it's an easy procedure to know and do already in the office.
Right. So really, that's a huge thing in terms of upskilling the workforce to be able to do these procedures. And I think that could have, you know, far-reaching implications. So maybe you're saying there's the multidisciplinary element with understanding the different points, you know, microbiology, dietitians, wound care specialists, nurses, doctors, consultants. And obviously, of course, you've got surgery itself, which is a big part. So seeing a melding possibly of the two and the three, I can really see that as, you know, a progressive step. So no, that's really, really interesting. And I think that's really opened everyone's eyes, I think, listening today, as to just how good surgery can really be. And like you said, the communication needs to improve between the two, you know, the podiatrists, surgeons, everyone together collectively in that multidisciplinary care. I do think that it is critical. So I'd just like to say a big thank you to you for coming on today. Again, for those listening in today, you're listening to the Foot Health Show on UK Health Radio, and you've been listening to Tim Nguyen from Pacific Point Podiatry in California. So for all those listening in the US as well, thank you so much for listening, and we'll hear from you soon.
Thank you so much.
We are grateful for the support the show receives from across the world. And if you are interested and feel this show matches your vision for shedding light on the importance of our foot health in enhancing our lives and preventing limb loss across the globe, please refer to the UK Health Radio website with details on sponsorship and donations.
The station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Thank you.
Welcome back. And if you've just tuned in, you are listening to the Foot Health Show on UK Health Radio. I hope you've enjoyed listening so far. And if you've enjoyed listening to the show as much as I've enjoyed making it, then please don't hesitate to contact me on LinkedIn or Twitter, and I will happily respond to your messages as soon as I possibly can. Meanwhile, here's a piece of music I hope you'll enjoy. That was a fantastic piece of music. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And now we're going to look at the four key ingredients to good footwear. Each week, I'm going to be saying this because I feel that it's important that whether we're a patient or a clinician or just genuinely very interested in looking after our feet, I think it's important to look at these four key ingredients. Number one, a deep and wide toe box. This is important because our first toe joint tends to take most of the load in the initial stage of what's known as the gait cycle, which is when we walk and we move. And in that process, the toes also play a key part in disseminating the forces that are acting on the feet. And the distribution of that force is aided by a deep and wide toe box. It means there's less chance of the joints being squeezed both at the sides of both the first and the fifth toe, but also it enables us to be able to flex the toe, our toes upwards and downwards in a motion that enables us to have better control and balance of our movement. The second key ingredient is a secure midfoot fastening, such as Velcro or laces. I mean, this is really important because without this, we are unable to control the forces across the foot and to stabilize the full extent of our movement. For example, a slip-on shoe may cover the entirety of the foot. It may protect the foot to some degree from stepping on something sharp or from coming across objects that may hit the sides of the foot. However, the movement or biomechanics of the foot, as we call it, may be impacted through shearing forces. So each forward motion can be impacted by the toes hitting the ends of the shoe because there isn't something to keep the middle of the foot in place. And that is why a secure midfoot fastening such as Velcro or laces is beneficial for us in our everyday lives, such as trainers, but also important in our indoor footwear, such as having a Velcro secure fastening for our slippers, if we choose to use slippers. Certainly important that we wear shoes indoors to protect our feet, because there can be objects that can be sharp, such as unnoticed sharp objects as pins, bits of shades of wood if they've come off objects, of furniture, etc. But really important we're monitoring our home and our surroundings as much as possible to avoid any accidents from occurring. Thirdly, it's really important to have a secure, stable and protective heel counter. This is the part of the footwear that essentially wraps around the ankle and the back of the foot, or what's known as the hind foot. This is really important also, as it keeps the foot stable and secure within the confines of the shoe. This means that when we commence what's known as the heel strike during the gait cycle, it means that we can move off without any slippage, without any changes to the biomechanics or the forces acting on the foot to a large extent. So something like flip-flops, for example, without that stable heel counter, it puts more pressure on the toes to be able to grip onto the flip-flop to keep us moving forward, which can in the long term result in toe deformities occurring, such as hammer toe or clawed toes. It's also really important, the fourth ingredient to round this off is a cushioned insole. Plenty of footwear may look aesthetically pleasing and very, very nice to possibly to look at and to wear or to notice to some degree, but without a cushioning insole, especially if we're walking lengths that require us to have that comfort, but also for there to be good shock absorption, we need to have a cushioned insole. So, for example, EVA as a material is something that supports the bottom of the foot, the sole of the foot, but also a material such as Poron can do similar. And these are two examples of some of the kinds of materials that are used nowadays. So if you're looking for insoles that would help your feet, these are two of many. And also I would encourage you to speak to your podiatrist or a professional in the line of podiatric medicine who can help you with understanding footwear. An orthotist is also a professional in footwear, in being able to make bespoke footwear too. So if you know an orthotist, they would be in a great position to be able to help you understand the right kind of footwear to be using. So thank you for listening. That's the four key ingredients of footwear. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the Foot Health Show on UK Health Radio. My name is Jonathan Brocklehurst, and today we have been exploring a topic that shows us just how important our feet are. This show is all about the significance of our foot health in our everyday lives, and the decisions that we make and the information we read and listen to relating to our foot health can be a beacon to others. That is why the Foot Health Show exists, to inform you of inspiring and innovative ways to address our feet and mobility in the current world. I look forward to you listening in and tuning in again next time.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week, folks. Thank you so much for joining me here on the Foot Health Show on UK Health Radio, your global, real, feel-good radio station. All that remains is for me to say, have a fantastic week. Keep safe, keep those legs and feet moving, and don't forget to tune in again with your friends next week.